Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ciappardini with the Go See Talk podcast. Thanks for joining the show again. Happy Saturday to you, whether you're in beautiful Hawaii looking at wonderful vistas or you're freezing your butts off in Dallas, Texas. We're thrilled to be speaking to six-string Jedi Kevin Kiner about his work on everything from Doom Patrol to Titans to the brand new HBO Max show Peacemaker starring John Cena. Thank you, Kevin, for joining the show. It's really excited to have you here.
My pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you for spending some time with us. You know, you think about what music has done to stage performance, theater, things like that. You know, now the music has really gone from video games to comic books. It's really taking these things that seem to be flat and giving them a life of their own. Can you talk about maybe some of the thought process of scoring something that's as colorful as a TV show or an animated property like Star Wars Rebels? Just what goes into something that doesn't really have a human component, but trying to give heart to something that seems colorful in nature?
Well, I think, I'm the kind of person, I don't really write songs. I write instrumental music. I hear melodies all the time. When I really hear things is when I see a picture or read a story or something like that. But I don't know where that comes from. I don't think Paul McCartney can tell you, you know, where yesterday came from or anything like that either. We don't know. I've seen so many interviews of people, you know, trying to describe it. You know, it is pulling something out of the ether. But in my particular case, it is inspired by other people's ideas, which are, you know, the comic books, the fantasy, the, you know, Superman or Titans or Doom Patrol or Peacemaker. You know, I hear a melody, and I don't know why, but and there are specifics. You know, obviously Star Wars is done in the style of John Williams, or was initially, not really so much anymore. You know, when I'm writing Bad Batch, it's evolved over the last 12 or 13 years that I've been working on the animated shows. But you know, it started with the John Williams sensibility. Peacemaker, the drill was kind of how can we fit the soundtrack sound, which was late 80s hair metal, early 90s hair metal, kind of how can we add the orchestra to that, or the hair metal to the orchestra, or a combination of electronics. So it wound up to be an extremely hybrid kind of score, but still based, I think, in rocking. You know, that score needs to rock, and it does all the time, I think.
Well, it literally and figuratively, it does rock. And you answered a question for me that I was dying to ask. I know that James Gunn properties are known for their careful curation of source music, but also the orchestral and the score component is just as equally well placed. But there's a lot of music that I've never, bands that I've never heard before, choir boys. And that was kind of new to me, even though I kind of grew up with like Slaughter, Winger, Neverland, and Steve Vai. So you are a 6-string, 8-string, 31-string impresario. How did you channel, and then you and Clint bifurcate that source music and make the music your own?
You know, we had discussions early on. Clint kind of did a bit of a similar process when he did The Wrestler. You know, as in terms of incorporating the sound of the needle drops and the soundtrack into the score. And, you know, at first it was just a general discussion. It wasn't really any melodies or anything like that. Just talking about the sensibility of the hair metal, like, and the sensibility of the late 80s, early 90s, and the ballads they would write. you know, they were unapologetically melodic, and, you know, to the point of almost absurdity, but not quite, you know, I mean, and so we leaned into that. We really leaned into, like, let's, when we do a melody, let's make it sing. Let's make it, you know, a real melody, the way in the, with the same sensibility that those guys did. So that was part of the process of it. You can hear that, you know, the soundtrack's coming out later this month. I think there's one of the first cues is where it's from episode one, when Peacemaker gets out of the hospital, or, and he goes to his trailer where he lives. There's a long cue, and it's kind of emotional cue. It's performed all on electric guitar, rather than piano. You know, you would kind of do an emotional cue like that more on piano, but we decided early on to make the emotional cues guitar and primarily electric, sometimes 12-string guitar, again, drawing from that kind of vibe, you know, that's what those bands would do too. They would put in a 12-string sometimes and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I noticed watching Peacemaker, there were some tender moments or some elements, times when you wanted to underscore the drama or the sadness, and it was done with a guitar, and I thought that was very well done. When you're used to hearing a different type of strings, whether it's a violin or piano or something, it's nice to hear that guitar slowdown. So your method is very well appreciated and noticeable. So, you know, the strong element of the show is the humor, and it's interesting when watching the Suicide Squad, you don't know a lot about these characters, and it seems like characters like Harcourt, who become something different as the show goes on, almost gives you, maybe as a composer, an opportunity to where in episode one, you might have thought that the palette or the sound of the show was one thing and then it evolved. What type of, what was the process of going from episode to episode when your narrative is not confined to one runtime?
Well, I mean, I think I don't know if I want to say conceptually or just actually in the way both conceptually and the way it was realized, it wound up being kind of an 8-hour movie. You know, and one thing James Gunn really drove home to us was the emotional journey that Peacemaker was on and that Chris is on. And you know, who he is as a human being, his struggles, his relationship with Harcourt and Adebayo and with the team, his inner struggles with his father, obviously, and the values that he was brought up with, which were pretty horrible, and yet coming to terms with that, as you know, I think he's a pretty good guy in, you know, in the depths of his person. So, you know, the music had to take that journey as well and kind of connect, you know, connect him as he's taking his emotional journey and as he's learning about himself and about others and about relationships and stuff. So, and that was really important. And really, that is, I know it's the humor and it gets us all. That's kind of what hooks us in and what, you know, that's the fun part. That's the icing, you know, that tastes really good. But the real substance of Peacemaker is his emotional journey throughout this.
Well, I think that's really well stated and important to note, because a lot like Harcourt developing from the movie to the show, obviously Peacemaker is somebody who has to win fans by turning over a new leaf or having an arc. I think one of the best lines in the show, if this isn't quite spoiling, he's saying, I don't care how many men, women, and children I have to kill to keep the peace, but I'm not going to kill children. So it's sort of this sort of hypocritical nature that is funny, you're right, but it also speaks to him on a more emotional level. And so I'm glad that you were having those discussions about what notes to literally hit.
James is, you know, he's an incredibly talented writer, and you know, there's not that many writers in Hollywood that are that good. And whenever you infuse a story with an emotional journey, that's when it becomes really real, and that's when it has meaning. And you can have all these other fun things around it, which are amazingly fun things, you know, but the real meat of it is in the emotions.
You know, I spoke to Marco Beltrami, who just scored a TV show last year called 9 Perfect Strangers. And he uses a phrase that says, writing for music or movies and television is not pure music, because you're writing for to picture. So the reason I asked about how you might develop a sound from episode to episode, he and Miles Hankin say that they never saw the last two episodes, or they never got information about the last two episodes. So not seeing as a composer, or knowing the story ahead of time, they didn't quite know where to take the music themselves until they had to react to the last two episodes. So when you talk about this being maybe like an 8-hour movie, that's really all I was getting at, is maybe having the whole story and kind of plotting your pace, as opposed to, you know, going with your gut almost on a day-to-day basis because you didn't know what to expect.
Well, we did see the last episode, and we saw scripts, and you know, I think for us, it was, yes, you have to be in the moment, and you know, when it really comes down to it, you're scoring what's happening right then. But knowing that certain things were going to happen, and I can't really say, you know, because it doesn't happen until later, as episode 7 and 8, 6, 7 and 8. You know, it's nice to sort of foreshadow that. Nobody will really know that I'm foreshadowing it, but you know, at least I was, you know, and in the same way, yeah, you know, so that's really interesting what Marco says about it not being pure music. It's not. It's in the sense, like, you know, Bach was just, he was writing pure music and tunes. Other classical composers were still sometimes writing programmatic music, maybe based on Shakespeare or based on their own imagination, or a ballet, say in Stravinsky's case, you know, with, you know, but it was still quite pure music. They have, you know, when you hear analyses, say of a Beethoven piece or something, or Mozart or Stravinsky, whatever it is, and you're like, wow, I didn't even realize he's using this motif in a really unusual way. I didn't even hear that. And these professors get so into it, it's their life's work, you know, they analyze every little note. Sometimes I think they're completely wrong, but other times they are, you know, you can see where Mozart is, you know, he's using motifs over and over, but in different ways, in ways you may not recognize. And I think we sort of did that, not in classical terms, but in terms of story. We're using motifs, and we're using little licks and sounds and things like that that are going to foreshadow something that's going to happen later. And you're going to hear that sound again later on, and it's going to be completely subliminal. You know, nobody's going to probably realize what's going on while you're watching, but it is going to be part of the. And I think that adds just a little bit of depth to the emotion and intellectual authenticity of the score.
And it's also fun too when you can do variations. I would imagine that when you can slow something down or speed it up, or you know, it really gives the theme, or gives what you're trying to do with your music another life. So this is your second time working with Clint Mansell. You guys worked tremendous Oh, third. My mistake. I really have a soft spot for the music in Doom Patrol. And I think if we could make it, maybe take a slight segue, I just want to get maybe your thought process or backstory on some of a couple cues.
Sure.
Robot Man and His Daughter and Aftermath in Cloverton. You may not, wow. They may be like an M2 something technical to you. Yeah. But
well, I remember Robot Man and His Daughter. I mean, that was super heavy. That was very heavy. You talk about an emotional journey, yeah. And you talk about, you know, where Cliff is. I mean, wow, that guy's a mess.
Well, how do you know, the idea of scoring is not overstepping your bounds unless it's called for. So, you know, yeah. You support the narrative and underscore what's happening. But how do you, I mean, I could listen to first Doom Patrol, main titles, Robot Man and His Daughter, and Aftermath and Cloverton. There's just, that doesn't even, you could play that for somebody, not tell them that's tied to a TV show. And you would think that's some of the most compelling music, both a lot of electronics, but great emotion and heavy drums. There's so much going on. I don't really know if there's a question there. There's just so much you put into that. So,
I don't, you know, again, those are just things that, you know, I'm a baseball fan and you don't hit a home run every day. And if you did, it would be boring, I think.
Fair enough.
So, but those are great moments and thank you for appreciating them. And, I'm glad when they happen.
Well, just really quick, I want to geek out for a second. There's about a 45-second moment in Aftermath and Cloverton that just feels like it's about 1 minute in, and it's not even a minute. The sequence I'm talking about is about 42 seconds. But there's just a driving motif to it where the strings build, and it's just so energetic. And I just, as a film score fan, and this is TV music, I just want to tell you, grand slam. Not even home run, grand slam. Thank you.
Thanks. That was great. Thank you.
So now jumping back quickly to Peacemaker. So on that note, you've got music that you don't want to overstep its bounds. But if you're channeling these hair metal bands, these ballads, what's the liberty that you have to write music, then put it in, and then do you get an opportunity to give it more adrenaline? And then let's see, where am I going with this? Sometimes when you hear this out of the context of the show, you know, you could turn it up in your speakers and it won't overplay the dialogue. But do you write something loud, then tone it down for the show, but it was always loud to begin with?
No, I mean, if there's dialogue, we try to stay out of that a little bit if we can, but you still have to, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, you want to write a good piece of music, specifically with like action scenes, you know, I mean, there's a lot of sound effects and stuff like that. And the music sometimes gets through and plays really loud. And other times it gets buried by sirens and gunshots and people jumping off buildings and stuff. So, I mean, sometimes you try to stay out of the way of things, but if it's like talking about an action cue, you know, even though there's going to be a lot of gunshots and stuff, I feel, you know, most of the time the cue needs a lot of energy and it needs a, you know, and especially with the, you know, heavy guitars and the drums, it's going to take a broad audio spectrum up and, you know, that's up to James and the mixers when they mix everything together as to how they let things poke through and stuff.
Okay. Well, being a musician, you work with different tradespeople, sound engineers, orchestrators, conductors. We mentioned you work with Clint Mansell, but you also have a bit of musical lineage. Can you talk to us a little briefly about working with Sean and Dean?
Yeah. So Sean has been working with me for about 9 years and Dean, I think maybe 6 years. And, you know, I've been scoring television and film for about 38, 39 years. And I think I would have burned out, you know, maybe 10 years ago or whatever, if the boys hadn't started helping me. And they bring a freshness. They bring a younger sensibility, a hipper sensibility to my stuff. And, you know, I've kind of mentored them in the best, I mean, the best master class I can imagine being able to teach, because, you know, I've done a lot of clinics and done a lot of, and I continue to, it's really rewarding. But I never get to work with people on the kind of level that I work with my sons on, you know, and just talking things through philosophically or tonally or exactly, you know, brass tacks and talking about, well, that note doesn't work there or whatever. I mean, we really go in depth, and it continues to be a really great experience. They bring a lot to the table. They really do. And, it's a big part of what, you know, really it's no longer a Kevin Kiner sound. It's a Kiner team sound, really.
That's awesome. And having that dialogue, sometimes I'm a creative myself. I work for an architecture firm. And so sometimes we tend to ask ourselves, hey, are we overthinking this? Is the approach to this building this way? Is the bar location too much? And most people as consumers or passerbys are never going to know the thought process that went into it. But if you do something right, there's just something that rings true, even if you don't really know what you're like, even if you don't know music or architecture, it works.
Yeah. You know, and speaking about that, I mean, we will go down a road and step back sometimes and say, you know what, let's just jam, because sometimes you are overthinking things, you know, and other times it's really great to put, you know, great thought and detail. Again, it's kind of a case by case, and, you know, whatever kind of gets, you know, again, my baseball analogy, sometimes, you know, you bunt and sometimes you steal bases and there's all kinds of different ways to score and to move things around, and it's the same with our team in writing music. There's a lot of different ways to get a cue done, and you know, I think we'd get bored if we just did it one way all the time. You know, if it was always just a jam, it's just like you kind of get sick of jamming. But if it was always an intellectual exercise or something like that, then you get pretty burned out on that. So yeah, we just run the gamut with it, I guess.
Well, let's round this out by talking about some of the tools of your trade. I am a amateur guitarist. I have a Taylor, but you have a variety, like a scary variety of guitars on your website that I've never even heard before. But the one I can relate to the most is probably a Taylor 8-string, and it looks like they're doubled up on the G and D string. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a baritone, so that's actually the A and the D string.
Oh, it's A and D. Okay.
Yeah, well, because it's baritone, so the lowest string's a B, so it goes B E A. It goes B E A D F sharp, because the fifth string. The interval is the same between the D and the between the G and the B string. Now it's the D and the F sharp string on a baritone. Anyhow, sorry about that. But yeah, those two are doubled up, and you know, being a baritone and having some double strings, it's a bear to play on the left hand in terms of, you know, fingering and stuff like that. You got to be pretty strong. But it really has an amazing sound. It's really cool guitar.
Yeah, I have a Taylor. I forget the version of or variety. It's a standard 6-string. But mm-hmm. When I saw that, I was wondering. So what off the top of your head, can you recall maybe what you would have used this in or what project?
I know I used it a lot on Hell on Wheels. I use it in a new show I'm doing called Promised Land, which is coming out on ABC on Monday nights in a couple of weeks. It's about a very wealthy wine making family. They own a vineyard in Sonoma, and it's kind of Latino based. I co-write it with Gustavo Santaolalla. So I use it in that because that has a lot of acoustic guitar kind of things going on, and we're always trying to get. I'm using it a little bit in a new show I'm working on for AMC called Dark Winds, which is about Navajo Nation and Navajo police, kind of a Navajo detective series. So that's where it gets used.
Okay, great.
I have like 100 guitars, man. I it's a bit of a ridiculous addiction, you know.
I wouldn't doubt it. Actually, I would probably think that you'd be less skilled and legendary if you had anything less than 100 guitars. So, but can you talk to me about the White Falcon? I know this doesn't really correlate to Eagly in Peacemaker, but
It's just got that great Gretsch sound and kind of, I mean, it's not exactly what Chet Atkins played, but it's kind of that kind of vibe to it. There's a guitarist who I just love. And in fact, if he's going to do a concert around us, I want to see him. His name's Tommy Emmanuel, and he plays Chet Atkins kind of, where he's the whole one man band. He plays the bass and the chords and the melody all at the same time, like a stride piano kind of a thing. And that's really fun on the White Falcon. And then, you know, I don't think I used it on Peacemaker, but I was definitely sometimes going for a older, less thick, you know, I didn't want the humbucker Les Paul kind of sound. And I didn't really want the bright Strat sound. I don't think it was a White Falcon, but it was something with like maybe gold foil pickups or something like that, that I used on the Peacemaker when he goes to his trailer. Man, I forget what guitar I played that on. Dang it. Anyhow, I love the White Falcon. So it's a great guitar.
The dobro?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's usually played with a like a glass slide, and that's kind of it has a resonator, a metallic resonator in the middle of it, and it gives it a kind of a, you know, it's that desert sound that you hear, like Ry Cooder did that, used dobro quite a lot. And then you'll hear it really in the down home kind of country stuff. It's used. I don't really use it with a slide that much. Funny enough, when I really want a trashy sounding like guitar, I'll play an acoustic finger picking cue on the dobro. And it'll sound kind of in the same way like Jack White likes to use really thrashed, you know, like unrefined instruments. And it really has that kind of sound to it. Very, very rootsy, very earthy kind of. Mm-hmm. Like put a box and put some strings on it, you know.
Or like Kurt Douglas did with a turtle shell in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Completely different.
Yeah.
So is that like... Is a dobro more of a industry term for a steel guitar, or is it
lineage? So dobro, it was invented by a French brothers named the Dopera brothers. And then after that, a company named National started making ones completely out of metal. And it started getting heavy use in like bluegrass and country and stuff like that. You know, I don't even know what year. The reason I know about the Dopera brothers is one of them owned a shop in the city I grew up in. It's called Escondido, which is down by San Diego in California. And I wish to heck I'd bought a dobro from them, because I mean, from the inventor, you know, what a better way. But I do have a Harmony 12 string that I bought from him and that he worked on a bit. He was quite old when I was a kid, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still, that's a great takeaway. Well, then I hate to press my luck. Do you have any, emotional or connection to a strum stick, and what is that used for?
That's just the thing to try to just get a weird sound, you know. I mean, we're, as film composers, we're always searching, you know, I will take a violin or a cello bow to almost anything, you know, including my refrigerator, you know. I'm not exaggerating.
Please elaborate.
Well, you just, you know, you get the metal to resonate, you know, a little bit. And so the same with the strum stick, or I have, you know, these Middle Eastern instruments. One's called a tambour and another's called a chumbash, and I'll bow those and just kind of get a round kind of thing, drag the bow across it. I mean, I'm by no means proficient or anything like that, a virtuoso on any of these instruments. It's more about getting an unusual sound and placing that sound in the right spot, you know, for a project I'm working on.
Gotcha. Well, with the knowledge you have, how and when do you lean on somebody to whether give you an idea about how an instrument that you may not know too well, or maybe just, you know, in the case with Clint, how do you guys divide up what you contribute to something?
Well, that's actually very difficult to describe because, I mean, Clint and I started working on Titans together. And the very first bit is we got together and traded a bunch of sounds. Like, you know, the kind of the drill with Titans and it spilled over into Doom Patrol and then a bit into Peacemaker was to kind of use these 70s synths, you know, electronic instruments. And so, you know, Clint, similar to James Gunn, has this encyclopedic knowledge of bands and old gear and things that's just really, really a great resource to mine. So we started, you know, and then we started developing themes and Titans and licks and maybe arpeggiations or things like that were based around these old analog synthesizers. And so that's kind of got us started. And by the time we started doing Peacemaker, you know, Clint and I have more of a shorthand. And there was one time there, I'm listening because James gave us all these playlists for every episode, you know, and in bands I'd never heard of, as you know, as you said. And I heard this one chord progression, and it kind of gets used a lot by these 80s cats, you know, in the early 90s, the hair bands. And I'm like, man, that's kind of the quintessential chord progression that happens. And I mean, it happens on several songs. And I was about to email Clint, and he calls me, and he says, hey, I found this chord progression. And it was, I mean, and I'm like, there is, you know, you are going to think I'm bullshitting you, you know, because I'm just literally about to email you this. And so, you know, we're kind of connected. It's interesting how that works.
That's great. Well, I'm glad that your collaboration has yielded such amazing fruits. And it's been a pleasure to speak to you. And if I could just give you one bit of praise, I remember watching a long time ago, Rebels, Spark of Rebellion. And when I saw your name in the credits and I heard what you did with Williams's iconic music, I couldn't believe how well you dipped into that that palette, but then really made it flourish and made it your own. It felt so extrapolated and just so well done. So I've always been wanting to, I gave you a emotional high five years ago, but physically, digitally, I want to just say thank you for that as well. That was great.
Well, thanks. That was hard as hell. That was really hard to do. So I appreciate getting some reward that somebody appreciates it. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, do appreciate it. I mean, I know Dave Filoni really does, but man, John Williams is pretty deep, and being able to, you know, kind of dig into his stuff and yet also not totally rip him off. And it was a very, and continues to be a really difficult exercise intellectually, you know, just a really, really, a lot of thought goes into that.
You know, I can only imagine, because when something is so great, to either, like you said, try to rip it off or extrapolate it, just, you know, it could yield some terrible results. So you did the opposite. So
thank you. Thank you.
Well, I tell you what, you mentioned some projects that are on the horizon for you earlier in our exchange. Is there anything you want to lead tail off with or plug specifically?
Yeah, if anybody wants to hear my music, they can go to my website. I don't, you know, you just play it on my website. I don't charge for it or anything. It's kevinkiner.com. I try to keep updates about what I'm working on and stuff. I think Peacemaker's just going up there. I got to wait till the soundtrack comes out before I can start putting cues in on my website. And then, like I said, Promised Land is going to be a really cool show on ABC on Monday nights. Dark Winds is going to be a really cool show coming out on AMC in about a month, I think. Bad Batch continues to kick ass. I'm working on another thing with Dave Filoni I can't really talk about. Probably shouldn't even said that, but there's a lot of good stuff happening.
Well, great. A lot like Chris Smith said himself, Kevin Kiner doesn't care how many eardrums he has to kill to keep making great music. But Kevin, it has been a joy. Thank you so much for your time. And everyone, check out Peacemaker. And pretty much anything that Kevin touches is gold. So thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thanks, Mark.